Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Learn from 46 years of sustainable development in the desert of Egypt. If you can grow an agriculture company in the desert, you can grow it anywhere. And mind you, this is not a small player. These are 2,000 farmers soon scaling through carbon credits to 40,000 farmers and more than 2,000 people working on the processing side. If you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today with Helmi, the CEO of Sekem, the legendary biodynamic farm, and so much more. But we're going to get into that in Egypt and beyond. So I'm very, very happy to have this moment today. And so welcome to the podcast, Helmi.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to an interesting, inspiring talk together.
Yeah, because following sounds a bit creepy, but I've been following the Sekem journey for quite a while. Obviously, not as long as it exists, because it's been there for a long time, and following it through the work of Triodos, your engagement, of course, through Aosta as well, and now the introduction came. So a shout out to Gadi, who made this happen, who might be listening at some point. But I want to start for anybody that thinks Sekem, I've heard the word, but I don't really know what I should imagine. Is to take us, of course, this is an audio medium, so we have to talk visually, like to take us, what is Sekem? And if people have only heard the word and have no idea what it actually is, how do you normally introduce yourself if you're like at a dinner party and somebody asks, what do you do?
I mean, Sekem is the manifestation of a dream my father had some 46 years ago when he was looking from Austria, where we were living, to his home country, to Egypt, to the desert in Egypt, to the challenges Egypt is facing, whether it's ecological challenges or cultural or social or economic challenges. And when he, out of his new life in Austria, at a certain stage decided that he wants to create a model for system change, a model which could prove that even in Egypt, system change is possible, on all levels, in all fields, he came up with this idea of Sekem. And obviously...
And it's safe to say that got a bit out of control. Yeah, it's not like... It didn't stay with a dream, I think.
No. When he came up with the dream and explaining that this dream is all about biodynamic agriculture in the desert, and it's all about economy of love in the supply chain, and it's all about potential unfolding for all the people involved, and about community development and corporate social responsibility. Obviously, everyone told him that this is never going to happen, and it's never happened before in the desert and in Egypt and the region. And so I think it's safe to say that it was very much considered a mission impossible by everyone around him. And everyone thought this is going to fail very soon. But against all odds, and this is why we have this talk now, a miracle unfolded over the last 46 years, a miracle in the desert where today thousands of biodynamic farmers all over Egypt work successfully with biodynamic agriculture. And 2,000 co-workers in Sekem process their biodynamic raw materials and sell them in the local market. And thousands of kids go to our schools, and many, many thousand students go to our Heliopolis University for Sustainable Development. And so a miracle which is difficult to grasp, because it's a beautiful oasis in the desert.
You live there, right?
Yeah. I live there, my family, but many, many other people, many other families from different walks of life, from different countries, from different religions, Egyptians, Arabs, people from South America, people from Asia, people from Europe. So we are really quite global community there. And we prove every day that it's possible to work in such a community without any issues between religions and ages and genders and all these kind of things. So it's a really intentional community, a learning, living organization where we every day try to reflect on ourselves and reinvent what we are doing. And I think it's also fair to say that it is the result of a very holistic approach. As you may have felt from this dream at the beginning, it's about biodynamic agriculture. It's about a new alternative economic system. It's about a new different education system, which is focusing on potential unfolding, and a different societal development approach, which I think altogether can yield such miracles everywhere in the world. It just need people who engage on all these four levels of sustainable development in a passionate reflective mood.
And do you feel like this dream came to your father? And then how intentional was it to start with the restoration or the regeneration or the agriculture piece? How did it come that was the first angle and not, for instance, the education piece or not? Maybe it also was, but like, what was the first step? I mean, because I think like there are many people that have dreams like this and things come to them and then most of the time nothing happens. And so what were the first steps in making this dream unfold? And also in a very challenging, just from a landscape perspective, this is not an easy place to farm or to do anything. So just take us to that place. Like, what was it like to start on the, I mean, you weren't there on the agriculture piece. Actually, you were. Like, what was it like to start there with basically desert and turning into an oasis?
I mean, I have to clearly say, when you start in Egypt, in any piece of desert which has an access at least to water sources, you always start in a very basic situation. It is sand and stones, which have for thousands of years not seen a lot of vegetation and a lot of life.
Yeah.
and hence there is not a lot of life. There are not a lot of people or animals or anything around. It's real desert as you imagine it in the pictures when you look at it from Europe or from anywhere else. And this is the situation my father started in. We had an access to water from the Nile, but the Nile was about 2-3 kilometers away. And so we had to dig a well and we had to search for electricity as a source of energy to get out the water. And then we had to plant trees and to create this wonderful place called Sekem today out of nothing, of real nothing. And I think one of the very good manifestations of the craziness of this idea is that the first two big investments we ever did in Sekem were the obvious one, a tractor, when the water came out to start working on the land. And the other one was a big piano, which my father basically got in the same day as the tractor. So really to show that it's not about only soil management, but it's about much more nourishment of souls at the same time. And so I think this picture, which everyone considered very crazy at the beginning, but it gives you an idea how we tick in SECEM. It's always about people at the first place, and then it's also about all the things people need, whether it's food or economic activity or any other things.
And now, just to give an idea, like what kind of products or what comes off the land, and what are you? You mentioned on the processing side, obviously, and you work with a lot of farmers now as well on the biodynamic side. What kind of products is SECEM known for, both in Egypt, so locally and regionally, but also outside? Because actually in many German supermarkets and many other places, you can buy a piece of SECEM, let's say, or something that has been harvested on former desert. Just to give an idea, what kind of things would you be able to find, depending on where you live, obviously?
I mean, it's manifold. What I can say is that as we are applying biodynamic agriculture on all the farms we are working with, on our own farms, but also the farms of many farmers all around Egypt, it is including wheat and cereals, vegetables, but at the same time, medicinal herbs and cotton, for example.
The full spectrum
of every crop available in Egypt.
Is that surprising to people that you can grow that in the desert?
I mean, it is it was surprising to us.
You can grow it both from a profitable side of view, like sustainably over a long time, but also from an environmental point of view, sustainably over a long time. You're not extracting, you're basically building soil, even though these are quite demanding crops, or at least they're known in the rest of conventional agriculture as demanding crops.
I mean, yes. It was surprising to us how good biodynamic farming works in the desert. And at the same time, all these crops we are producing are crops which are used and cultivated in Egypt. So we, yes, over the years now have also cultivated some new varieties, some new things. But in the basic a portfolio of plants is the same as every other farmer in Egypt would use in our area. And the wonderful thing is that with compost in the heart of everything, the black gold for the farmers, you basically can enlive dead, what seems to be dead soil. It's not never dead, of course. And this miracle of watching white sand getting brown and black, sequestering carbon, getting a better water holding capacity, giving space for billions of microorganisms, handling salinity issues, producing healthy crops. It's quite an experience when you can really see it from the very beginning. It's spectacular to see what can be done in short period of time, actually in few years. So anyhow, what I want to say is, it was a surprise for everyone, including ourselves. My father was not an expert in agriculture, but it was at the same time also a very rewarding experience, which motivated hundreds and in the meantime, thousands of farmers in Egypt to follow our example.
Yeah, because basically in many other places, I mean, you have degraded land, but hardly desert. I mean, many places, the desert, of course, is growing, but you really go from not zero, because it's not fair to say the desert is without life, but with very little life, to something relatively fast, as you mentioned, quite quickly. And just, you mentioned the portfolio of crops. If you compare SECEM just visually, as we have to speak visually here too, you said it's quite a normal portfolio of crops compared to the other farmers in the region that farm conventionally. How do we see the difference if we walk, smell, feel like bare feet on the farm of the farms of SECEM, of farmers that work with you, compared to the conventional? How do we know we are in a biodynamic one?
I mean, it starts with the overall design of such a farm. It starts with many trees and bushes, a lot of biodiversity, many birds and other animals in between, and obviously bees and cows and sheep and other chicken and so on, always being there on these farms. We have never any farms where we have only one crop. This monocropping attitude is not there. It's more or less mixed crops. It's very often agroforestry concept, especially in the desert where you have to create your own microclimate. You always start with trees first and bushes to create some fields, to create some space, safe space for plants and animals. And at the same time, you will see also peacefulness, beauty, and hopefully smell and sense health, an overall healthy ecosystem with a lot of diversity.
And you mentioned the first two investments we did were a tractor and a piano. How long, what was the journey on the money side? In was it easy to keep going cash flow wise, or was it very, very, let's say, up and down, difficult wise? What was it a roller coaster? What was the journey on let's say the financial side, from, because of course now you have a size and a scale, and of course export partners and processing, and it's a very different journey 46 years later. But do you remember how the first years were from because it's not a simple topic, but the economic side of things?
Very, very difficult at the beginning. First of all, because when you invest, especially when you invest in any land reclamation, agricultural project, it always needs time, and it needs more time than in trade, in industry, obviously. So you have also to support whatever you are doing with a way to balance out the seemingly higher prices for organic or biodynamic products by, in our case, by adding value, by producing out of our biodynamic crops, pharmaceutical products or foodstuff. Where you add a lot of value because you pack it in tea bags, or you make an extract, or you make a tablet. And having said,
did you do
this,
that immediately? Did you grasp that opportunity of processing and going for the higher dense stuff and not selling vegetables which are objectively full of water on the local market?
I think that my father was very clear from the very, very beginning that we want to sell these biodynamic products on the local market. And to do this and to sell it on the local market, we obviously had to overcome the seemingly higher cost of producing organically. And so he had this idea adding value to a lot of, spirit on matter. When you have ideas and you take a raw material of a medicinal herb and produce out of it an extract, and then out of the extract a tablet, or you clean your herbs and then you pack them in tea bags, and all these kind of things were there, were his ideas to possess the biodynamic raw materials into products which could be sold on the local market with a higher value, so that we could absorb the biodynamic premium, if you wish, and still sell at a conventional price, because there was no market for organic or Demeter in Egypt, obviously, 46 years ago.
And when did the market, let's say, beyond Egypt start? When did that came? Was it you looking for that market, or came the market looking for you?
No, it was the market coming for us. We were very much focusing on the local market. But then at a certain stage, when people heard about this crazy idea in the desert and Demeter products, chamomile and calendula, then obviously some people came and asked. And we always tried to support those who really wanted Demeter products, couldn't get them from another place. We never entered into any kind of competition with any anybody from Europe or something. We always were very clear. We don't want to compete. We want to support. Luckily, still the case that we never were really exporting more than 20-25% of what we do. This is still okay as long as we are doing really specialized products which people in other countries like Europe, the US, the Arab countries and so on could not produce themselves.
Yeah, and probably also shields you from shocks and currencies and export, which is always more difficult, like shipping it far away is, I mean, we've had many interviews on that, and it's always tricky. It might be interesting. Oh, a cash crop I can sell far away for a very good price, but how long and how stable that is always really depends. And so then how important has the role of has there been another role for investing? I mean, you said, of course, a big investment we did was a piano and a tractor. But if you think about investing in general, like what are other things that come to mind except those?
I mean, the whole investment in biodynamic agriculture, because it starts with the cows and the animal husbandry, and it has this whole ecosystem of a farming organism, of course. But besides, it was always also the investment into processing, manufacturing, and
people.
Yeah. And yeah. Obviously, from the very, very beginning, also in a lot of people and people's development. We were committed to give to all of the people who are co-workers at SACEM 10% of their working time for their potential unfolding, which is easy when you are two or three people. But today, when we are 2,000 people working, this means that there is a whole training academy working just on our own people all the time, huh? Because we have basically all these people continuously in different training programs.
And so when did that, you talked about the university, there's of course the children education piece. When did the education piece, both inside and also outside, really start to unfold? Was that completely from the beginning, or was that a moment later in time?
I think it was to an extent from the very beginning really part. And so all this kind of, you could call them rituals, to come together in circles, to reflect on what you do. In a small circle, obviously, it's much easier when you are 3, 4, 5 people at the beginning. And then you grow. And this is what happens. Today we have everyday circles of thousands of people, different circles, one joint circle in per week and so on. So I think it was there from the beginning, and it did grow with the organization. And it would be not so very easy to install something like this into an existing organization from one day to the other, because, you know, it needs to grow with you and your living organism.
And I read somewhere what has been the role of outside finance or outside capital? I think you've done something with the IFC. Has it been important, or has it been mostly, let's say, self-finance from within in terms of cash flow, in terms of savings, in terms of what the organization organically could grow, which is, of course, also fitting. Like, has there been, what has been the vision there? What has been the practicalities on, let's say, outside finance?
I mean, you can imagine that it's not easy to finance agricultural activities anywhere in the world, and crazy biodynamic agriculture in the desert.
No, I thought it was really easy to fit it in a bank building and to convince a banker in New York to do that.
Not in New York, not in Cairo, but not even in Europe. It's not easy to get funding for this. And so we, at the very beginning, because we wanted to spread the idea, we wanted to give an example, as I said, for a system changer. It was never our intention to stay a lighthouse in the desert, an example for something beautiful which nobody else is doing. What really matters to us is that farmers can see our example all over the place, all over Egypt, and that they can get inspired and just do it and engage. So to spread the idea, spread the initiative, we needed external funding, and local commercial banks were not interested. So the development banks, including the German Development Bank, Triodos, GLS, but also IFC and the Austrian Development Bank and Euro Credit at the later stage, were just development banks who had this green and ethical banking on values core idea. And so it was for us very important to have these partners from early on to be able to grow our initiative, which would not have been possible without them, with commercial or other banks.
And now looking back on 46 years, and what would you tell, let's say, the investment world? I think many things that you and also your father, like, that maybe sounded crazy back in the day have turned out to be, first of all, very real and very possible and very practical and in many cases, the only way forward. So without sounding like, oh, I told you so, what would you tell the banker in New York or people that are managing either their own money? Of course, we can argue if it's their own money, but let's say they're managing their money or managing other people's money. When it comes to food and agriculture, what would be your main message to them? If we would do this, I would like to say, if we would do this in a theater and we're on stage and it's 200, 2,000 people in front of us, they're all working in finance, they're working with money, and they get super excited, of course. And then they go out of the room, and usually what happens is that Monday morning, nothing changes. So what would we give them as the main message for Monday morning that something changes? What would be your message?
This is a good question. I to put myself into the mindset of a banker is not so very easy for me as a farmer from the desert, but my message
still, you know how to create something from nothing, which I think, yes, like, we shouldn't underestimate. That's sort of the creation. I mean, you're there when life gets created. That's a pretty, yeah, important role. So I think we should listen to you regardless of what we think, if it's crazy or not.
Look, what I would try to highlight with our example behind me, of course, is that regenerative or biodynamic or organic or whatever agriculture is what every one of us as a consumer, as a citizen, as a human being needs to feed himself in a meaningful and healthy way, to feed his community in a meaningful and healthy way, but also to feed nature with all its natural kingdoms in a meaningful and healthy way. And that by just following this regenerative agricultural practices, the whole society would be much better off, whether it's a rural society or an urban society, both of them would benefit. And ultimately, this way of agriculture is the most economic one ever, because whatever we consider today expensive, organic, biodynamic, or regenerative, in versus agro-industry, conventional agriculture, is a mere illusion, is a mere Maya dream, where just through externalizing of costs, we seem to have cheaper products on the shelf, when in reality, they are much more expensive. And counting on their effect on the climate, which are future generations, biodiversity, future generations, or directly pollution on water, air, effects on health and social web of communities, we are already much, much better off. So food and the life forces of food are what we need, not also for a healthy life, but also for healthy thoughts and feelings. So it's the best investment ever.
And where do you meet the most, let's say, skepticism or resistance? Or where, not because for sure you've seen many, but what's been the most surprising skepticism or resistance that you've encountered? Because you do many talks, you travel a lot, you've met many, many people. And for sure, you've had many people also visiting SACEM. Like, what has been the most surprising resistance or skepticism?
I think there are many, many folds, many different ways of resistance. The one which is the mainstream, in a mainstream thinking, in an Adam Smith religious thinking about natural science and materialistic and capitalistic ideologies, what we are trying to lay out as economy of love and sustainable development just seems so crazy and so much ahead of its time that people think this is a nice, crazy dream, but cannot survive, cannot work. So they all get inspired and passionate and love our food and buy our products, but they just think it's too crazy to be true. This is the majority of people, and they still believe egoism is the only real motivation for people and profit maximization and shareholder value, the real purpose of economic activity and so on. Okay. So for them, what we try to prove with our example is just too far away from everything they believe in. And so I think we need to find a language which they can understand. Very often our language just does not reach them. But the others who even really get inspired and want to do something and maybe even have the intention to take our example to a next level, to another country or continent, very often go into the trap of trying to copy, which will never work, because it's not about copying an recipe or an example like Sekem. It's getting inspired by it, but you always have to apply it on your own context, in your own community, out of your own experience with your own people, in a different way, hopefully much better, but always different. And so it didn't work with those who do not believe our ideas, but it's also difficult actually with these thousands of people who come and get inspired and want to do something like us, that only very few of them are able then to really get this on the ground in their context.
And is that also then triggers utter skepticism, because they say, yeah, but it never repeats. So why is it just a nice dream?
I mean, the most important, as I said, to get the mainstream on is to prove in their language that what we are doing is extremely efficient, productive, profitable, that it's even in their way of thought, very, very competitive. And this is where we, since 2017, really focus on. Since my father passed away and we developed this vision for Egypt 2057, our major focus now is not to grow Sekem anymore or Heliopolis University or our hospital, but really to disseminate our idea. And to disseminate our idea means that we try really to translate these ideas we have into the language of people around us, into their way of thought, accepting that they look into a different world, see a different world when they wake up in the morning. And yeah, and then, for example, in agriculture,
How do you do that? Where do you start? Like, because you must lose some of the, or maybe quite a bit of the nuances. Like, that's a tension between sharing your vision and your world into, even in other languages is already difficult. Imagine only in like the extractive agriculture language. Like, talk to us through about how that works in agriculture, for instance, and what have you learned in the last 6 years on that? Because I'm asking for a friend, meaning also all the listeners, basically.
Yes, I got it. Now, for agriculture, for example, when we did our relaunch of the idea, we want all 7 million farmers of Egypt to get into regenerative agriculture. Starting with the 2,000 we have at the moment, it seems a very, very long way to go until 2057. And then we studied and asked ourselves, why isn't it happening when we have this example of Sekem and the 2,000 farmers, where everyone can go and see successful agricultural practices, healthy products, and so on. And beside many reasons, which I don't think are really very important.
Yeah, what do you see as the main ones?
The main one is it looks more expensive, and many, many people consider organic or biodynamic or whatever more expensive. And
it looks like from the consumer side or also from the farmer side?
No, from the consumer side. The farmer is following the needs of the consumer. I think farmers, if they would see more demand for organic products, would luckily switch over.
So that's
over.
A big piece to work on.
But it's the consumer, yeah. And in reality, as I said before,
it's an illusion. Yeah,
yeah, it's an illusion. But this is what it looks in the
at the moment. This is what I see in the shelf. Like on the shelf, I see two sort of similar products. I mean, I'm doing air quotes. Nobody sees that. Sorry. Yeah. Similar products, and then I see a different price, and our simple brain sometimes goes for the cheaper one. Unfortunately.
Exactly. And so, what I can tell you from our example, what we did. By studying this at our university, we did the true cost accounting exercise, which you know from Volkert very well. And exactly the same as in many, many other countries, obviously organic and biodynamic is much cheaper when you factor in all the externalized costs. Now, this is not happening. And interestingly, neither in Egypt nor in Holland, when you tell this to the consumers, when he goes into the supermarket, it will change his purchase behavior. Opposite, whenever there is a tense situation and a war between Russia and Ukraine, then 20% of those who are inorganic already will drop it again because they consider it too expensive. Huh? So what we are facing is 6% of people who are inorganic and 94% who consider it too expensive, which is obviously a disaster. But in Egypt, it's even more than 94%. So the question was, how can we get organic or biodynamic products cheaper than conventional products? This would be obviously a lever for system change. Because if in all the supermarkets, the organic products are the cheaper ones, I'm sure many, many more consumers would switch. And quickly, we could reach the critical mass and the tipping point, and then things would happen by themselves. So we looked into all these externalized costs and found actually that the one single factor where we think we have the highest possibility and opportunity to monetize some of the ecosystem services of farmers was CO2 certificates. Carbon certificates. And so we did a comparison of biodynamic versus conventional farming in Egypt. And when in conventional farming, every acre is emitting 5 tons in Egypt, so 10 million acres, 50 million tons of emissions in Egypt in the agricultural sector. In biodynamic farms, we sequester up to 15, 20 tons per acre. So a potential.
Per year?
Per year.
Wow.
So this would mean that Egypt's farmers, if they would go to organic or biodynamic farming, could single-handedly offset all emissions of Egypt, or at least reduce them by 60, 70, 80% or something. But the question is, how can we monetize? So we were looking, we developed our own economy of love, agricultural carbon credit scheme, created a standard, created a registry, and started to sell these carbon credits in the voluntary carbon market. And guess what? It worked for us at SECAM. It worked in the prototyping. Then we scaled it up to 2,000 farmers all over Egypt in 21 and 22. We launched at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh this idea and told everyone, look, agriculture can be part of the solution. Just honor farmers as climate heroes and give them a fair price for carbon certificates if they deserve. And guess what? Now we are upscaling it to 40,000 farmers for the next 2-3 years in Egypt.
Which means there are 38, I'm doing the math in my head, 38,000 farmers that are going to be in transition. Am I correct? Or they already are somewhere in organic?
The 2,000 are in transition. No. The 38 will start. These are farmers around the 2,000, but want to make the same transition. And the same transition means what? They go from conventional to biodynamic farming. Which is
as we just heard at the 20 minutes ago. That's possible, but a massive shift in terms of land, in terms of chemical exposure, obviously, to them in terms of feeling, in terms of like the land physically will completely change in a couple of years.
Exactly. And then they would sell their biodynamic products at the conventional price. So no price increase, no premium. So they can sell in their village for the price they were selling all the years.
If they want, or if they, I mean, depending, of course, how the organic market develops, but would they, some might be also tempted or rightfully
so. No, we want the organic market to go to the conventional level.
To go down, wow.
So to really help also consumers in Egypt who are much under pressure at the moment through high inflation and so on, not to pay a higher price. And then they get the CO2 carbon certification and carbon prices, which will increase their income 50 to 100% anyhow, which will enable them to live a better life, send their kids to school, and so on and so on. So,
and I'm guessing cost will drop as well if you turn off.
Yes, and their cost, of course, if you can't factor this in, they are really cheaper than conventional products. So we will have no price increase for consumers. We will have healthy, biodynamic products, better livelihoods, and a substantial service to mitigate climate change. And this is a win-win-win, which we hope.
And who's buying them? Like, in a sense, because we hear a lot of discussion on the carbon credits. Is this the soil carbon credits as well? And who did you find in this market as well? Because I hear a lot of people also in the carbon credit markets, let's say, holding and waiting a bit because nobody knows what's happening in the world anymore. Like, how were you able to sell those credits already?
I mean, we started obviously with our partners in the supply chain. We developed immediately a local version. So we have a platform on the Egyptian stock exchange so that Egyptian companies can also buy, because we don't want only to sell to Europe or to US. And then we are now also offering it, of course, to other voluntary carbon markets, wholesale markets, where companies who want to offset their carbon footprint can just buy the best available carbon credits in the world, which are the economy of love ones now. And it's actually a very fast growing market because we are all on the race to zero. Everyone wants to go to zero. Nobody can, as a human being or as a company, ever go to zero. So we all need to balance out our emissions with some sequestration from natural based solutions, whether it's trees or soil or compost making and so on.
Are you scared for a bubble on like the carbon market side or not so much?
I expect that for the next 30 years, when the whole world is on this race to zero, this market will continue to grow. And in the perfect world, I hope we do not need a carbon market, because I'm not particularly interested in carbon markets. I'm interested in healthy, good biodynamic products. And just by giving the right value to the biodynamic products over the price of the product, I think in future generations, we will not need to have these two markets. And by the way, we are working on biodiversity credits and other ideas to
get some
returns for our farmers, who are always the losers. Our farmers for the last 200 years were always the weakest in the economic supply chains. But we want to make them again well off, well paid for their services and their efforts. And it would be great not to need now just this kind of shortcuts.
Yeah, are you disappointed about the shortcut? Because your analytics suggested, like, look, this is, we don't pay the full price for our products, or we seem expensive, but we're actually not, which is not fair. And it feels like, like we have to go around a bit to somehow find the opportunity of payment somewhere else. And is that being pragmatic and let's deal with what we have now?
I think it's just a development phase. And because we want to take everyone in and we want to feed everyone in with biodynamic products, I accept that we are not all on the same level of understanding and income and so on. But it's a stage, and on the long term, I don't fear that this stage is not going to be there, because this is true cost accounting, what we are doing. It's not about a Maya bubble world we are creating, but it's a real cost for the world, for the next generations to come. And how to deal with this real cost maybe is something to be discussed or to develop. But at the moment, I'm quite happy to do it as as we are doing it and really supporting my farmers to come to a better income and producing better products.
And is there a risk, like, if these 38 farmers that start their transition soon, that if the market of the credits goes up and that or down, etc., that they will at some point maybe be stuck in the middle of a transition and suddenly the payments are not there? How do you make sure this is not an amazing thing that starts and then gets stopped just before interesting things start to happen?
Look, first of all, no risk, no fun. Eh? So we need to take some risks. As an entrepreneur, you need to take risks.
We don't want to put it on the farmer.
never on the farmer, but we have to have the courage that we also believe that we learn while we go, we learn while we walk with our next step. Our feet, our hands can be more intelligent than our heads sometimes. So we don't need to think everything to the end. Sometimes we need also to move before we lose all of our time and effort and lives just about thinking about all the good reasons why it's not going to work. But at the same time, I see that the more and more our farmers are engaging with us, the more and more the crisis is hitting the world and is affecting the system change, the narrower the gap between the cost, even without carbon credits, of organic and conventional food gets.
Do you see that now, like in this inflation times?
Chemical fertilizers are getting more and more expensive. Pesticides are getting more and more expensive. And I can already energy is getting more and more expensive. So I can already now see many farmers who are very, very happy to do this because they are needing less expenses, less investment. Having better and more healthy and resilient soils is always a good investment for a farmer. So I think these farmers, by all means, will always be on the winning side. And I hope they will also have a much, much better income than the conventional farmers, the comparable conventional farmers will have.
And now, switching sides a bit, I always like to ask this question. If you would be on the investor side, so let's say you're a banker in Cairo or in New York or Amsterdam or London or Delhi, and you had quite a considerable amount to invest. I usually use $1 billion, but maybe with all this inflation, I have to put $10 billion. But let's say a lot of money, like more money than most people will ever, ever even dream of having, or probably shouldn't dream about that. But let's say you had to put it to work, which is quite a burden for many people. What would you focus on? Would you focus on the desert side? Would you focus on the processing? Would you focus on something completely different? But if you had to put it to work, so investing, and at some point, it could be very long term, but at some point it had to come back. Yeah. What would be your main areas of focus if you had a big amount of money to put to work?
You can imagine that I'm very biased towards agriculture and forest management. No, I'm not an expert. I believe this is a wonderful solution also by itself, but I have no experience in it. But what I would invest in is land reclamation, agriculture, forest management, agroforestry systems, and the whole food system and supply chain until the final consumer. So this would be...
And would there be like geography focused? Like, would you focus and say, okay, I know... like the super challenging environment of a desert, like to show that it's possible going from very challenging to very flourishing? Or would you say, I would actually pick somewhere slightly easier, like Germany or Austria or somewhere else? What would you focus on?
I think I would stay in Egypt because Egypt is with the desert and all these unbelievable challenges we are facing regarding water scarcity, climate change, and so on, a very vulnerable environment. And I think to stage the example, the model for system change in such an environment would make it much easier for everyone to believe that it will work everywhere else also.
And if people, I mean, we've talked a lot about the soil side or the agriculture side and not so much on everything you do around that. Like, but if you had to, I'm not saying guess, but say how important that is compared to the things that come off the land. I mean, all the education you do, the circles, like everything you do around, especially around the people that live on the farm, work in the processing, etc. You said at the beginning, it starts with people and then the rest comes. Is it 50-50? What do you normally describe, let's say, the social side compared to the environmental, the agriculture piece?
I mean, I have to be honest, we believe that it's all about individual human potential unfolding and community development.
And it happens and to believe, be on a farm in this case.
Yes, yeah. And we believe that the economy and the farming side and all the infrastructure and so on are serving this purpose, serving the purpose of human and natural and community development. Huh? So I would
Which
always
means it could be anywhere.
It could anywhere. Be anywhere.
It could have been anywhere else, depending on where your father anywhere. Would have come from.
And it, and I think there are huge challenges everywhere. It's not only in Egypt that you have unbelievable challenges.
And I'm fascinated about that piece. Of course, he chose where he came from, but also one of the most challenging, at least from a visual desert. It's not a very very hospitable place, let's say, where you easily make things flourish. But anyway, if you do, the comparison before and after is very, very stark. So, which makes it extremely powerful. And like, how actually on the challenging side, how has climate change and water scarcity and other challenges been hitting you? Has it been very, very tough over the last, let's say, 10 plus years? Has it changed a lot in terms of simply making this continue? Or as you created your microclimates, etc., you're sort of shielded from a lot of the challenges we see in other places, let's say, that are at the fringe of or at the border of where we used to consider easy to farm, and now suddenly we also have droughts in the Netherlands and we have droughts in Germany and droughts in many other places. But how has that been over the last decade or so?
To be honest, because Egypt's agricultural systems forever, and specifically in the desert, are very managed agricultural environments, we are not yet affected too much by natural droughts or too much rain or things like this, but can see a huge difference between what we are able to achieve in our farms, how our soils look, how our plants look, and those of our neighbors. So we can see the difference between conventional and biodynamic farming with our own eyes, in the color of our farms, trees and plants, easily. But I cannot say that the environmental challenges have hit yet Egypt too high. I know that Egypt is going to be the second most vulnerable country in the world, which is a disaster, of course, for future generations because of the very low delta area, the big delta area. But at the moment, it's not yet very, very obvious.
And I like to ask this final question, but usually it's not a final one. But if you had a magic wand and could change one thing in our world, actually, I usually ask it on food and agriculture, but in this case, it could be broader than that. If you had to change only one thing, what would that be overnight?
Only one thing, huh?
Only one. Yeah, people always go for multiple ones, but we don't do that.
I think I would wish to see true cost accounting applied across industries, all economic sectors. So no allowance of externalizing or hiding or whatever, playing around with the real costs of goods and services.
And do you see we're getting closer? I mean, there's a lot of conversation, discussion, some early experiments as well in some supermarkets in Europe, also some shops to start at least have that conversation, what the real price should look like. Do you feel like we're getting any closer to justify or to not to justify, to actually have more examples on that? Or is it still very, very far? Has it changed over the last 40 years? That's also, or has this always been, oh, it would be great if we paid the real price, but we don't? Or do you see a path towards that actually happening?
I think I think I can sense, let's say, some change and some more awareness for the things. Not at the level and speed I wish, not reaching critical mass or the tipping point of 20, 25 or whatever percent yet, but I feel it will soon come. And things like our example with the carbon credits and so on could actually contribute. So I'm very optimistic. I'm obviously very optimistic and can see the change happening and coming in.
And that would sort of mean, I mean, that then the carbon side of things or the carbon credit side would be especially interesting if food companies get involved in that, because then they would start to inset and start to actually be sort of forced to work with their farmers and suppliers. Do you see any of that already happening? Like I actually don't need as many of these carbon credits if I would be changing practices with my farmers or suppliers. I don't even know where it comes from, but let's work in my supply chain.
I think it's coming. Yeah, I think this whole focus on the climate question will create more awareness for more sustainable practices in all fields, all sectors, of course, but also in agriculture and food systems. Yeah.
And with food and ag, we have a lot of discussion or conversation, and maybe hope as well, for the nutrient density side of things. So the quality, that of course health, of course, actually a lot of research suggests that that's true, but it's not such an of course, for the general public, but healthy soil lead to healthy produce and healthy gut systems and healthy yeah. people. Do you share that excitement and optimism around that on the quality piece?
Yeah. No, I would say yes, absolutely. I believe that there is a tight connection between the biome of the soil, the biome of our stomach, the biome of our soil, of our souls. Huh? There is this kind of connection, and I think that it really this one health approach, which is currently a new fashion in the world of system change. I think it's happening and it's getting more and more relevant. And I hope very, very much that more people will understand that our health is related more to our farmers than to our physicians, that our health, 65% of our health is connected to our food, not to our pharmaceutical products. And if we want to get more healthy, we have to change the food system, but we also have, of course, to change the system, how we live and how meaningful we live and so on.
And I mean, that probably your father knew 46 years ago. So do you feel that it's different now? Like we are, because I have the feeling we have talked about this connection actually for quite a long time, but it somehow feels, but maybe that's just my little bubble, but that we're getting, that there's a lot more conversation at least about that piece now. But I don't know if we're just kidding ourselves and hoping that that will be the key for a lot more consumer interest for this type of real food, etc. Have you felt, because I'm assuming the biodynamic movement has been trying to communicate this for a long time as well. Like, look, it is a different product. It's not the same. It's not only because we don't have the externalities or very different ones, we also, there's something else in it. Do you sense that there's something different brewing there as well, or not yet?
I sense that something is coming up. I cannot say it's on the high side, and I don't see it yet approaching even the critical mass.
Like the carbon credits are definitely.
I think the carbon credits are more advanced, but it will come. COVID and Corona have opened a door into new questions in regard to the health of the planet, connection of the health of nature and health of humans and so on. So I believe, yeah, it's coming, but again, you know how it is, with this, all these early ideas.
And do we need more research then, or do we also need like studies like you did with your university of how to communicate, or what the barriers are there? What do you feel like is missing for this idea to pick up speed and get to a critical mass?
I think more research on the biome and the connection of the biome of our soils with the biome of our guts. And so I think a lot of more research would help to convince even those who are not inspired geeks, by this idea, like us, spiritual ideas of it, but will get it from the natural science point of view.
Fair enough. I want to thank you. I want to be conscious of your time and thank you so much for, first of all, the work you do, but also for coming here to share about it and give us a mini look into your world. So thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for all that you do.
Thank you for this inspiring discussion, and looking forward to catch up again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.